Yes, Abram had known how to communicate his exaltation of spirit. He was named Abiram, that is to say, "My Father is exalted," or also, probably just as correctly, "Father of the exalted." For in a way, Abraham was God's father. He had perceived him and thought him into being. The mighty properties which he ascribed to him were probably God's original possession. Abraham was not their creator. But was he not so, after all, in a certain sense, when he recognized them, preached them, and by thinking made them real? The mighty properties of God were indeed something objective, existing outside of Abraham, but at the same time they were also in him and of him. The power of his own soul was at certain moments scarcely distinguishable from them. It interlaced and melted consciously into one with him, and such was the origin of the bond which then the Lord struck with Abraham. True, it was only the outward confirmation of an inward fact, but it was also the origin of the peculiar character of Abram's fear of God. For since the greatness of God was something frightfully objective outside of him, yet at the same time coincided to a certain extent with the greatness of his own soul and was a product of it, so was this fear of God somewhat more than fear in the regular sense of the word. It was not alone trembling and quaking, but also, and at the same time, the existence of a bond, a familiarity and friendship. In fact, Forefather had sometimes had a way of going about with God, which must have aroused the amazement of heaven and earth, if one did not take into consideration the extraordinary involutions of the relationship. For instance, the familiar way in which he addressed the Lord at the destruction of Sodom and Amorah was not far from insolence, considering the awful greatness and power of God. But after all, who should be offended if God were not? And God was not. "Hearken, O Lord," had Abram said then. "It must be one way or the other, but not both. If thou wilt have a world, then thou canst not demand justice. But if thou settest store by justice, then it is all over with the world. Thou wouldst hold the cord by both ends, wouldst have a world, and in it justice. But if thou dost not mitigate thy demands, the world cannot exist." He had even accused the Lord of double-dealing, and upbraided him. Once he had revoked the flood of water, but now he would invoke the flood of fire. But God, who probably could not have dealt otherwise with the cities after what had happened or almost happened to his messengers at Sodom, had taken all that Abram said in good part, or at all events not ill, for he had enveloped himself in a benevolent silence. This silence was the expression of a tremendous fact, which had to do with the outward side of God, as well as with the inward greatness of Abraham, whose own actual creation it probably was. The fact that the contradiction in terms of a world which should be living, and at the same time just, resided in God's greatness itself. That he, the living God, was not good, or only good among other attributes, including evil, and that accordingly his essence included evil, and was therewith sacrosanct, was sanctity itself, and demanded sanctity. Oh, wonder! He it was who had dashed in pieces Tiamat, and cloven the dragon of chaos. The exultant cry with which at the creation the gods had greeted Marduk, and which the people of Abram's country repeated every New Year's Day, belonged by rights to him, the God of Abram. From him issued order and joyous confidence. It was his work that the early and the late rains fell at their appointed time. He had set bounds to the monstrous sea, the residue of the original flood, the home of Leviathan, that in its most awful turbulence it could not pass beyond them. He made the sun to rise in its creative power to the zenith, and at evening begin its journey to hell. Likewise the moon to measure time by her ever-recurrent change of quarters. He made the stars to shine, likewise ordered them to form pictures. And he ruled the lives of men and beasts, nourishing them according to the seasons. From places where no man had been, the snow fell and watered the earth. whose disk he had fixed upon the flood of waters, so that it never, or only very seldom, swayed or shook. How much of blessing, of goodness, and of benefit was there in all this! But as a man who conquers an enemy, by the victory adds unto himself the properties of the conquered, so God, it would seem, when he clave the monster of chaos, embodied in himself its essence, and perhaps only thereby grew to the full height of his living majesty. The struggle between light and darkness, good and evil, blessing and fruitfulness upon this earth, was not, as the people of Nimrod believed, the continuation of that war which Marduk waged against Tiamat. Neither the darkness, the evil and the unknown terror, the earthquake, the crackling lightning, the plague of grasshoppers darkening the sun, the seven evil winds, the dust Abubu, the serpents and the hornets, none of these but were from God. And if he was called the Lord of the Pestilence, it was because he was alike its sender and its physician. He was not the good, but the all, and he was holy. Holy not because of goodness, but of life and excess of life. Holy in majesty and terror, sinister, dangerous, and deadly. So that an omission, an error, the smallest negligence in one's bearing to him, might have frightful consequences. He was holy, but he demanded holiness too, and that he demanded it by his mere being gave the Holy One greater significance than that of mere awfulness. The discretion which he enjoined became piety, and God's living majesty the measure of life, the source of the sense of guilt, the fear of God, and the walking before him in holiness and righteousness. God was present, and Abraham walked before him, consecrated in his soul by that outward nearness of his. They were two, an I and a thou, both of whom said I, and to the other, thou. It is true that Abraham composed the properties of God with the help of his own greatness of soul, without which he would not have known how to compose them or name them, so that they would have remained in darkness. But after all, God remained a powerful thou, saying, I, independent of Abraham, and independent of the world. He was in the fire, but was not the fire. Wherefore it would have been very wrong to worship fire. God had created the world, in which such tremendous things happened as the storm wind, or Leviathan. This had to be considered in order properly to measure his own outward greatness, or, if not to measure it, at least to conceive it. He must be much greater than all his works, and just as necessarily outside of his works. Makom, he was called, space, because he was the space in which the world existed. But the world was not the space in which he existed. He was also an Abraham, who recognized him by virtue of his own power. And it was just this that strengthened and fulfilled Abraham's sense of his own ego, which was not at all minded to be lost in God, to become one with him and be no more Abraham, but rather held itself stoutly upright in face of him, at a great distance certainly, for Abraham was but a man and made of clay, but bound up with him through knowledge and consecrated by the high essence and presence of the deity. It was on this basis that God had made his compact with Abraham, that covenant so full of promise for both sides, of which God was so jealous that he would be honored entirely alone by his worshippers without the flicker of an eyelash toward those other gods of whom the world was full. For here was the important fact. Through Abram and his bond, something was come into the world that had never been there before, and which the peoples did not know. The accursed possibility that the bond might be broken, that one might fall away from God. Much besides did forefather know of God, but not in the sense in which others knew of their gods. There were no stories about God. That was indeed perhaps the most remarkable thing, the courage with which Abram represented and expressed God's essence from the first, without more ado, simply in that he said, God. God had not proceeded, had not been born from any woman. There was also beside him on the throne no woman, no Ishtar, Baalat, mother of God. How could there be? One had only to use one's common sense to understand that, considering the nature of God, it was not a possible conception. God had planted the tree of knowledge and of death in Eden, and man had eaten of it. Birth and death were of man, but not of God. He saw no divine female at his side, because he needed not to know woman, but was Baal and Baalat at one and the same time. Neither had he children, for the angels were not so, nor Sabaoth, who served him, nor yet those giants whom some angels had begotten upon the daughters of men, led astray by sight of their lewdness. He was alone. Such was the mark of his greatness. The wifeless and childless condition of God might perhaps explain his great jealousy concerning his bond with man. However that may be, it certainly explains the fact that he has no history, and that there is nothing to tell of him. Yet even so, one may only take all this in a qualified sense, referring it to the past, but not to the future, if indeed we may speak of the future in this sense at all. For God did, after all, have a story, but it referred to the future, a future so glorious for him that his present, splendid as it always was, could not compare with it, and that very discrepancy between the present and the future lent to God's sacred majesty and greatness a shadow of strain and suspense, of suffering and unfulfilled promise, which we must frankly recognize in order to understand the jealous nature of his covenant with man. There would come a day, the latest and last, which alone would bring about the fulfillment of God. This day was end and beginning, destruction and new birth. The world, this first, or perhaps not first, world, would be dispersed in ultimate catastrophe. Chaos, primeval silence would reign once more. Then God would begin his work anew, and more wonderfully than before, being Lord of destruction as Lord of creation. Out of chaos and confusion, out of slime and darkness, his word would call up a new cosmos. Louder than ever before would ring the jubilations of the onlooking angels, for the renewed world would exceed the other in every respect, and in it God would triumph over all his foes. So it would be. At the end of days, God would be king, king of kings, king over men and gods. But then, was he not that already, even now? Of course he was, in all quietness and in the consciousness of Abram. Yet even so, not everywhere recognized and admitted, and thus not entirely realized. The realization of God's great and boundless kingship was reserved for that first and last day, for the day of destruction and resurrection, when, out of the bonds wherein it still lay, his absolute splendor would rise up before the eyes of all. No Nimrod would exalt himself against God with shameless, terraced towers. No human knee would bow save before him, no human mouth give to another praise. God, as in truth from everlasting, now actually would be Lord and King over all other gods as well. In the blare of 10,000 trumpets directed slantwise at the skies, in the singing and thundering of the flames, in a hailstorm of lightnings, he, clothed in majesty and terrors, would pace away to his throne across a world praying with forehead in the dust to take possession, in sight of all and forever, of a reality which was his truth. O day of God's apotheosis, day of the promise, expectation, and fulfillment! It would, be it remarked, embrace the apotheosis of Abraham, whose name thenceforward would be a word of blessing, with which the races of mankind would greet each other. That was the promise. But this resounding day lay not in the present. but in the uttermost future, and until then was a time of waiting. This it was that brought lines of suffering into the countenance of God of today, which were the mark of the to-be and of the not-yet-accomplished. God lay in bonds. God suffered. God was held in prison. That mitigated his exaltedness. All the suffering might adore him, and he consoled those who were not great but small in the world. It gave them to feel scorn in their hearts against all that were even as Nimrod was, and against the shamelessness of vaunting greatness. No, God had no stories like Egyptian Osiris, the sacrifice, the mutilated, the buried and arisen one, or like Adonis Tammuz, for whom the flutes wailed in the gorges. Tammuz, lord of the sheepfold, whose side Ninib the boar did tear, and he went down into prison and rose again. Far be it from us, and forbidden, to think that God was associated with the nature myths. Nature, withering in affliction, freezing in anguish, that she might be renewed according to the promise in laughter and billows of flowers, with the seed corn that decayed in darkness and in the prison of the earth, that it might arise and sprout, with dying and sex, with the corrupt worship of Melech Baal and his ritual at Tyre, where men offered their semen to the god of abominations in base-begotten folly and deathly shamelessness. God forbid that he could have had any dealing with such affairs. But he lay in bonds and was a god of waiting upon the future, and that made a certain likeness between him and those other suffering godheads. Therefore it was that Abraham at Shechem talked long with Melchizedek, who alone might enter the temple of Baal of the Covenant and El Elyon, over the question whether and up to what point any likeness of essence subsisted between Adon and Abraham's God. But God had kissed his fingertips and cried, to the private resentment of the angels, "It is unbelievable what knowledge of me is possessed by the sons of earth. Have I not begun to make myself known through his means? Verily, I will anoint him."